Blog Talk Radio.
The politics of sequestration. Why is there no more civility in Washington, D.C. these days? That is the topic of today's Backroom Politics in a special edition live from American University's Temley campus in Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics.
This special edition of Backroom Politics has been pre-recorded. Please, no phone calls.
That's right, we're here live at the Temley campus of American University in beautiful Washington, D.C. This is a special edition of Backroom Politics, live from Shelley's Backroom, although not from Shelley's today. But joining me as they do every Tuesday is my usual gang of pundits. To my right, he is the eight-term member of Congress serving Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Hello, Congressman.
Hello. I think this is the first time in 2 years of this program I've been sitting to your right.
Enjoy that.
Yeah.
Enjoy that, liberal. To his left. Wow, this is weird.
My
to
God.
His left is the former floor chief for Congressman Gerald R. Ford. He is the longtime Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Justin.
Did you ever think that you'd say that you were to the left of Al?
I thought about it, and then I lay down and took a drink and went to sleep, and it went away.
Nice. And directly at my 12 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, is the former Undersecretary of Commerce, longtime Senate staffer, and distinguished fellow. He's also very cute and cheeky sometimes, but he is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, Justin, and let me just say, hello, Eagles.
Hey!
Let's go, Temley.
Wow. Populist. Hey, so much we want to get to today, but the big news coming out of Washington, D.C., and since this is a special edition, we're going to be having a lot of questions coming in instead of having callers. We're going to have the great students here at American University ask us questions. We're going to engage them. But the big talk right now is the fiscal cliff, is sequestration. The president has put a proposal on the table, which was immediately shot down by leadership on the Hill in the Republican Party. The Republicans put together their proposal, which surprisingly Speaker Boehner was calling a Bowles plan, which Erskine Bowles kindly came back and said, yeah, that's not my plan. But it is now getting tense where we thought there might be compromise. There is just more rhetoric. Speaker Boehner is now taking away select seats from select members of Congress for committee assignments. It is getting dicey. First of all, let's talk about this. Alan, what do you know about the Republican proposal to counteract the paper that went to the Hill on for the White House?
The Republicans felt compelled to respond to the Democrats, pardon the expression, regurgitation of the president's budget. The president a year ago put forth a budget that included higher tax rates, a higher tax burden on wealthier folks, and a variety of modest little changes around the edges. And they put that forth and tried to call it their proposal. Well, there was nothing really new in it. And then they said, if you don't like it, Republicans, give us something. Tell us what your proposal is. So the Republicans responded, if you will, in kind, with nothing dramatically different, except that some of what the Republicans proposed was part of this murky, failed, but almost successful so-called grand bargain that the president and Speaker Boehner almost came to agreement on almost a year ago, that both of these proposals have about $800 billion in new revenue over 10 years from wealthier individuals. Lack of specificity on both sides, because they're both trying to leave themselves some room to come together.
Now, Al, you're seeing a lot of the back and forth. You being a former member of Congress, you've seen almost—it's almost a tag teaming by the House minority trying to back the president's bill, but getting shot down continuously by a Republican majority in Congressman Boehner. And again, the word compromise never comes out of either side. Is there blame to go around for this, or who do we need to look at to show leadership in this?
Well, the easiest thing to say is you blame everybody, because I think there is blame that can be placed in almost every location. The real blame, in my judgment, goes to a fault that exists in each party. They're different. I think the Tea Party in the Republican Party has Boehner's foot nailed to the floor. He is resisting that.
But we saw signs of hope after the election. I mean, Speaker Boehner was talking compromise, let's work together, kumbaya. That all of a sudden has gone away.
Exactly, because they put another nail in his foot. You know, I mean, the Boehner's been around a long time, and he understands this game very, very well. He's a very good member of Congress, even though I don't agree with him on almost anything. But he's a very solid person, and he understands compromise is necessary. You got to remember, this is a guy who compromised an education bill with Teddy Kennedy, for crying out
right.
loud, if you want to see how he works with liberals. But the Tea Party are a bunch of people who don't really understand how government works, who believe that compromise is a bad word, and they make people, including their own leadership, and that's John Boehner, pay for it if he gets too far in that direction. Switch to the Democrats. You've got certain Democrats, particularly the farther left they go, who want to make no change whatsoever in any entitlement. And there's no way the math will work without making some changes. What they should be arguing about is what kind and where and how much, rather than whether.
Now, Bob, we're hearing the Simpson Bulls moniker come up again and again. It is something that we heard 2 years ago. It is something we heard a year ago. And it's now something we're hearing today and even as early as this morning. In Erskine Bowles' response. For those at Radio Land and those here, can you just give us a quick overview? What is Erskine Bowles as we know it today in its current form?
What Senator Simpson, former Senator Simpson, and Erskine Bowles, who was the chief of staff for Mr. Clinton, put together 2 years ago with a group. That was they were the two co-chairs of a committee of, I believe, 18 members, equally divided, Senate and House, Republicans, Democrats. They had to get a supermajority to get their plan adopted formally, which they failed to do. They had a majority, but not a supermajority. What they did was cover all the bases that Al was talking about. They went in and they talked about raising revenue. They went in and they dealt with adjusting some of the entitlement programs, not so much for immediate use with current recipients, but down the road, particularly with Social Security. And they also did a great deal of look at the tax code and made recommendations about what should be changed, examples, things like we have in our budget, our expenditures. We spend $4 billion giving credits and money to people who raise corn, and it goes to ethanol. And number one, we don't need that anymore. Besides that, everything is made with corn, the price has gone up. You don't need it anymore. That's an example of the things they said they ought to get rid of. That vote, they had to have 14 votes, and they had 12 in their super committee. However, since the time that they did that several years ago, the Erskine Bowles proposal as a broad outline of the way to approach the problems on both sides, both parties. Both parties were going to have to give some of the things that they are now saying they won't touch. The Democrats, as Al says, don't want to touch, the real liberals don't want to touch any of the entitlement programs. Republicans are refusing to budge on tax rates. They are talking about, as Alan said, willing to raise a substantial amount of money by changing the tax laws.
But Bob, we heard several key Republicans, especially in the Senate. We heard Lindsey Graham saying revenue generation was on the table. We heard House members such as Peter King talk about revenue being on the table.
Tom Coburn,
yeah. Also saying that, who's been a big leader. And at one point, we actually saw people like Grover Norquist. We thought that this would be the demise of the tax pledge. Is that true? Are we going to see this go away? Has Grover Norquist and others like that tax pledge, has that gone to the wayside?
Not according to Grover.
He's been all over. I don't know if any of this in the audience pays too much attention to Grover Norquist, but he is the guy who has gotten all the Republicans he possibly can, which is about 90% of the House and the Senate Republicans, to sign a pledge saying they will not raise taxes. Now, Grover has been smart enough to say, well, I don't mean changing the tax code, I mean the rates. And the Republicans are, in the House particularly, the Tea Party people, as Al said, are absolutely opposed to any rate change. They're not saying the same thing about adjustments to the tax code, which could raise a substantial amount of money, but not as much money as it would be if you change the rate for people earning over families over $250,000.
Cousin Al.
Well, the first thing I want to say is that any member of Congress who signs up to some third party that they will or they won't do something like that and write it in concrete is forgetting that he owes his loyalty to his constituency, not to a Grover Norquist or the AFL-CIO or anybody else. And so I'm deeply offended to begin with that so many people have been willing to sign this pledge. Secondly, once you sign something like that, it is so hard to back away. So you in the process of signing up, you make it more difficult to solve the problem.
Well, we talk about people who have signed the pledge. I mean, Tom Coburn, senator from Oklahoma, came out and said, hey, you know, this is nuts. I don't have to stand by this. This is a piece of paper.
About a half a dozen have said that, and they'll probably get away with it. But I wouldn't be surprised if that number will not grow much more and if it may, in fact, shrink. Grover is on the Hill working today, you know, and Grover is got a horse, he's got a whip and a chair, and he is backing some of these people back into their cages.
Alan Moore.
Yeah. People talk about Grover Norquist as though he is some super powerful person. He conceived of this idea 20-some years ago to get people to pledge that they will oppose any increase in taxes. For the purposes of Republican politics and winning primaries, people signed on. They weren't thinking that this is some particular mechanism that was going to come back and haunt them and tie their hands. Over time, it's turned out that it has had some of that effect. I don't expect a lot of people to step forward and say, Grover Schmover, I don't care. That was then, this is now. They don't have to come out publicly and say that and invite people to attack them. The real measure will be when push comes to shove and we move towards a real deal that has revenue in it and significant revenue in it and some significant changes or promises of change, which is usually the way these things are done, changes that will have to be made over the next 8 or 9 or 10 months because it requires legislation, for example, to increase the eligibility age for Medicare. You have a big package, and at that point, people vote aye or nay. And if that's a problem with some pledge they signed long ago, They will explain it then. They don't need to invite those kinds of attacks now from people who are going to be manipulated by, huh, what does this mean? Taxes, tax rates, tax reform, tax expenditures. I don't get all of that. Which rich people are somehow cheating, I believe that. Poor people are getting the short end. There's an enormous amount of manipulation and attempted manipulation on both sides.
But Alan,
of this.
I mean, we talk about manipulation. There's manipulation going on within parties. We're hearing Democrats saying that we're not doing enough to work with the Republican side. But at the same time, we look at the Republican Party. We've got people like Senator Jim DeMint turning around and calling Boehner's proposal an $800 billion tax hike. When we see that kind of infighting, is Washington now officially broken?
No, it's not broken. Is the government functioning?
Is it?
Yes, it of course is.
Is it functioning now?
Have we shut down the Washington Monument, our social
security? Well, actually, we have. Bad example.
For safety reasons.
I'm just answering your question.
We'll take it. Have we shut down the national parks? Have we stopped sending out Social Security? Is the military not getting paid? Are we not still building new airplanes
and
ships?
But we
muddle through. It's a messy, ugly, nasty process, and it's not a foregone conclusion that everything will work. Sometimes we have to force something on ourselves, which we did about a year ago with this so-called across-the-board spending cuts or sequestration. People thought, oh, that's too draconian. We will never let that happen. We'll get this done earlier in the year. Well, guess what? We didn't.
All right.
Now we're up at the end.
Yeah, all right, Alan. Congressman Alan, I'll give you this before
you
go to play.
You the wrong question. The wrong question is not, is government broken? It's, is the Congress broken?
And is Congress broken?
I think you get a very different answer. I think Congress is hanging on by a thread.
Well, all right. We're going to let that be the last. Bob, go ahead. I'll give you the last word.
No. Isn't it interesting? 10% of the public, when questioned, say they think Congress is a mess. Yet they voted the same people back. They love their own congressman, and their own congressman is part of the problem.
Well, we're going to let that be the last word for this segment. When we come back, we're going to take a deeper dive into the problem here in Washington, and we're going to start engaging the students here at American University Kenley Campus in Washington, D.C. Wow, that was kind of weak.
Yeah,
we got better at Georgetown. This is Beckman Politics live from Kenleystown. Oh, that one's going to go. I'm going to feel that one. This is Beckman Politics on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Backroom is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the size of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Back Room, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties. Thank you.
Backroom Politics in a special edition from American University Family Campus. We're having a great time here. We're having all the students joining us, and it's a great talk, great discussion. For the last segment, we started talking about the latest on what was happening with sequestration, with the fiscal cliff, and we got into that everlasting, ever-exciting topic of, is Washington broken? Is Congress broken? It is something that we love talking about. It is something that usually spurs good debate amongst the four of us or the six of us, whoever's at the table. But today we want to start engaging some of the students here at the table with us right now. What is your name?
Benjamin.
And where are you from?
The great state of New Hampshire.
Great state of New Hampshire. Awesome. Love it. Hey, Benjamin, what's your question?
In the news recently, the death toll in Syria has hit over 40,000. And today, in the paper I read that, the Assad regime is threatening to use biological and chemical weapons on the Syrians. Do you think the U.S. has a duty as the last remaining superpower to step up and help the Syrians?
Wow, softball. Oh! Bob, I'll let you run on that one first.
Well, the president has already said that we are aware and believe that they are bringing together the various components of their chemical arsenal, which are in different places and have to be mixed in order to become dangerous. They're beginning to do that. We believe they're beginning to do that. And the president has said, if they do that, serious consequences will ensue. Now, the president hasn't said, we're going to go in there, we're going to bomb you, we're going to kill Assad with a nuclear device. We haven't said anything like that. But what he has said is what normally is said, you know, by diplomats, and it's about as serious a statement you can make when you say serious consequences will follow if you do X.
But, Congressman, now let's go one step further than that, though. I mean, they've now been talking that there could be war crimes and war crime charges against Assad. Is that feasible? Is that likely? And is that the right way to go?
I have no crystal ball, but it seems to me that the president did something unique for him. Bob is right that the language is kind of standard diplomatic language, but he hasn't used much of it over time. And I had the sense that the president really meant things were going to get serious. And it occurred to me at the time he may well be talking about war crimes.
I mean, we're hearing stuff out of Syria that is pretty scary. I mean, chemical weapon cocktails. I mean, literally creating homemade sarin gas, Alan. That's got to give us pause and be a concern for allies like Israel and Jordan.
You know, what's depressing here is that it has taken this sort of mystery threat of biological weapons or chemical weapons to get, as far as I can recall, sort of a harder line from this president. Presidents are in a really, really tough position when bad things are happening internationally, and it's hard to find a situation that's any worse than Syria. About 40,000 dead, about 500,000 who have become refugees in bordering states, and more than 2 million displaced inside Syria. I was in a meeting in New York just a few weeks ago of a humanitarian organization that I am on the board of, something called the IRC, hearing reports from people in the field inside on the borders of Syria where women in camp after camp after camp are saying, we have had to learn to accept rape as the way of life during this time. This is Syria today. Now, what do we do about it as Americans? Do we say we're going to create a no-fly zone? Do we arm the rebels and then they're armed ongoing into the future, as is the case in Afghanistan? It's very, very hard to know what to do. I think a no-fly zone is the likely next step. We've heard reports that the Syrian rebels now have air-to-ground missiles. Well, if we had invoked a no-fly zone, they wouldn't have needed, I mean, the ground-to-air missiles that we didn't give them, but somebody gave them, probably Qatar. I have a lot of sympathy where the president is on the one hand. On the other hand, I think our response in light of the mood in America and Iraq war, Afghanistan war, et cetera, has been quite tepid given our recent past. This is the world we live in, and there's no easy answer here.
But we have another question here. Your name?
My name is Scott Hammersley, and I hail from the land of Lincoln.
Illinois. Fantastic. Yeah. Enjoy. What's your question?
So, gentlemen, I understand that in a basic Keynesian economic system as part of the United States run, during a time of recession, the government generally tends to do a few things, like the Federal Reserve will increase or decrease treasury loans and things of that sort. And the federal government, the legislative branch that is, will increase spending, increase loans and entitlements to those of poor and need, and decrease taxes. Well, the Democrats in Congress are recently talking about increasing taxes. I was curious if what benefits you thought this might bring, considering it's a counteracting balance of what the general theory of a Keynesian economic system does, and what do you think it would take for the Republicans to get on board with this increase in taxes?
Another softball. Okay, we're talking Keynesian economics here. Al, you want to take that one first?
No.
Well, leave it to the congressman. That's what you had staff for, right? Bob, you want to take this one first?
Yes. You're right. It's counterintuitive that would be a good idea. However, we have got to get a hold of our deficit. I think that revenue enhancements, I don't care. I don't, personally don't worry about whether it's rates or entitlement fixes, tax benefits, the mortgage interest, the charitable interest, and there are all kinds of things in the trade in the code that are just crazy. We do need more revenue. We don't have to, raise everybody's taxes to 50%. We don't need to do that. We just need to get enough revenue to start getting control of our deficit, which is now $16 trillion plus. As a matter of fact, in February, we're going to have to raise the debt ceiling because we're going to run out of room to borrow money. So it probably is helpful to have some tax increases, but we're also going to have to do it in connection with cleaning up some of our entitlement programs. We have to do it. We don't have to do it in a hard way that hurts present or near beneficiaries, and as far as their age is concerned. We have to look to the future and make sure that folks who are younger than that and will have years to in effect protect themselves from some slight increases, to let them get it done or do it in a prospective way rather than a sudden way.
I'm putting on my pundit hat, but I'm going to let Alan go first. Go ahead, Alan.
This is a horrendous dilemma that we find ourselves in, where short term we need stimulus. We have a very, very fragile economic recovery, and if we fall off the cliff and cut spending and increase taxes very abruptly, every economist says we have an economic disaster on our hands. On the one hand, those same people would say over the long term, our current deficit spending is unsustainable. $1 trillion annual deficits, $1,000 billion each year in a deficit. We're raising about 65 cents for every dollar we spend. This is not sustainable. So what Bowl Simpson did, and what other people, some other groups have talked about, is being very careful and gentle in the beginning, but making changes over a 10-year time frame. We don't always talk about 10 years, but all of these proposals, all these numbers we've even talked about here, they're 10-year numbers. No politician, though, and one of my great complaints about this campaign was nobody was being all that honest. We're talking about making the wealthy pay a little bit more, as though that was going to solve anything. But I don't blame politicians, on the other hand, for not wanting to say to all of you, okay, guys, you need to be part of an enterprise where you pay more and get less. You guys need to work longer for less money for a retirement that will be delayed and not as rich as you were hoping for. That's the world we live in, and that's part of this problem.
Al, Congressman Al.
One of the things that I think both sides are overlooking is the fact that this does not have to be as draconian as it appears, either the tax increases. I mean, why do the rich
care? You know, why did the Republicans care about the rich as much as they do? It absolutely astonishes me. Sounds like lousy politics to me.
Right.
Might explain why they lost the last election. But also on the Democratic side, Bob has some figures here, and I'll defer to him to mention some of them. But the Social Security was set up to take care of very poor people, people who had no pensions and what have you. My grandfather, who was the last blacksmith in the city of Tacoma, didn't have anything to fall back on. Social Security came in. Now you have people making $60,000, $50,000, $70,000 a year who are getting Social Security, and they don't need that Social Security, or they don't need that much Social Security. And so you have certain liberals over there saying, oh my God, don't take all that money away from these people who are not poor. And the result is we can't sit down at the table and start talking sense to each other and get this problem solved.
I want to jump in here real quick and give you my two cents on this. The one thing that we look at is, I think we talk about Keynesian economics, and we talk about sequestration. We throw all these wide theories all around. This is very simple, kids. We have set generation of revenue. This is Economics 101. I'm sure everybody's taking Economics 101 in here today. Simple. You can't spend more than you have. So if you either stop spending as much or you find a way to bring the revenue in, make more money, then you can spend more money. Very simple. We do not see leadership that are willing to sit down and go back to economic basics. We throw around cuts here, policy there, fixed tax loopholes. Is our tax system broken? Absolutely. Should it be fixed, revamped, clean slate? Absolutely. What we don't have is political leadership like what we saw back in the early 90s with President Bush 41, where here's a guy who runs on a system of no new taxes, gets elected, no new taxes. In 1990, his economic advisors go to him and say, hey, boss, we got a problem. We got no money, and we're spending it like drunk sailors. He says, I got to raise taxes. Cost him the election more than likely. There were other issues, but pretty much that did it. The reality is, if we took government growth, which is roughly about 8 to 10% a year, and we cut that down to about 2 to 3, we would see revenue generation. If we put a point, 1% of tax rate up on the block and said, look, everybody's going to feel the pinch, we could do that, we could knock this out. But nobody wants to talk to it. Why? Because part of the reason why is we're dealing with an uninformed electorate. We're dealing with people right now that will not sit down and take responsibility for their way they're governed. So now we have this problem. Congressman Al.
I remember being at an AARP meeting in my district in which we talked about all the horrible things that that Congress might have done to their retirement, to Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And then afterwards, I had three people come up and said, oh, by the way, don't let the Ways and Means Committee tax my oil stock.
Right.
Well, give me a break.
Alan, you want to jump in on?
No, I'll I have too many corrections that I want to make, so I'll...
No, go ahead. No. Now's the time. Oh, geez. Are you going to facts now? Is this what we're doing now? Bob Hines, real quick.
Let me read some of the numbers that Al was talking about, because this is interesting. I'll read a paragraph, about two sentences. One argument that is made by the Democrats is that most elderly are poor. Benefit cuts will further impoverish them. Not so. The Administration on Aging, which is an official government body, reports that in 2010, about 26% of the households headed by someone 65 years or older had incomes exceeding $75,000. Almost 20% had incomes exceeding incomes between $50,000 and $74,900. And 19% had incomes from $35,000 to $50,000. Now, you know, when you're older, you're not buying a lot of clothes. You know, you probably have paid off, if you have a home, most of your mortgage. It's not so much worry about these people on some benefit programs, but you can easily look at these programs and say, if we today change a little bit of the formulas so that people in the future will know what's coming, and the younger generation will not be surprised, but the older generation can afford to give a little bit. And it's certainly true that the wealthy can have a few more taxes taken out of their pocket because all they're going to do is buy another home.
Congressman, now, last word.
I agree with that, but the thing that I think you have to be careful of is the Republicans have a tendency to say when they reduce the level of what they call poor to about a dollar a year, you know. I think when you hit $35,000 a year.
Oh, you're too kind.
Wow. That's hurtful, Congressman.
I intended it to be. The Republicans get very, very sketchy about how they define poverty. And I think that what I said is right and what they're saying there in that article is right. But you just watch, try and run something like that through the Congress, and the Republicans will want to reduce it way below those, down to where it will start to hurt the genuinely poor. And you got to watch out.
That might be true, but it's also true that the Democrats will not let it happen in the Congress.
Alan,
just a word about Social Security. You guys have worked. You know that payroll taxes get paid. How many of you expect to get full Social Security benefits when you're in your 60s?
You have to clap because raising your hands doesn't.
Well, I'll explain if I get no hands. So how many of you do not believe that Social Security will be there when the time comes?
Now, clap. It's radio, kids.
A lot of hands there. And I bet we could go through a whole.
Can
host
I boo?
Of
no. No.
We could go through a whole host of questions about how Social Security works. What we've done with Social Security, politicians have done this, and we'll call them low information voters, like to accept this idea. They think, we all tend to think, I paid in for it, now I want it out.
Alan, I got to stop you real quick. We got to go to break. Is this going to be a long one?
We'll take the break.
All right, we'll take the break. This is Backroom Politics Special Edition, live from Tenley Campus at American University of Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
I'll tell all my friends, all my Harlem coquettes, Mr. Waller regrets, but who do you think he can get around? No. Tell the mailman not to call. He's coming home until the fall. And then again, I might not get home at all. Soon as back in town. Oh, that woman's back of town. Oh, my.
You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Back Room is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the side of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Back Room, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also a place for private parties. Thank you.
And we're back here at Tenley Campus at American University of Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio, semi-live at least. And we're continuing discussion here with the great students of the Political Science Department in the semester in Washington at American University. But I want to go back. Alan, right before the break, you were talking about a question that we got from one of the students about, you know, talking about the economic sequestration. You were talking about Social Security
right, being
on the block. Go ahead with that one.
Yeah, I mean, we've created this myth that you pay it in and then you get it out. Don't mess with it. Well, you don't pay it in, store it, and then get it out. You pay it in, and the way you pay in pays for your grandparents' benefits. So the money gets spent, and there's not a big account for everybody. The system is also heavily weighed to the advantage of lower-income people. So if you're kind of a low-income people for your life, you'll get your money back, compounded interest, in a matter of a few years. If you're kind of middle income, you'll get it back in maybe 12, 13, 14, 15 years. If you're at the upper end, you've paid in the most, you get the lowest rate of return, it might take you 20 years. There's a fact in this same article that Bob cited that the average sort of middle of the road person in Social Security and Medicare, if they live the life expectancy for a 65-year-old, they will have in their lifetime almost $1 million in benefits between the two. They will have paid in, however, on average about $700,000. So even this great grand middle who thinks that they paid for their benefits get a good deal, the upper end, it starts to disappear. We can change that, but nobody should not understand that the system on the benefit side already is more generous to the lower end.
Are you suggesting means testing?
I'm not suggesting means testing. I'm just simply talking about the facts of how the program works and how it becomes complicated to make changes when the myth that exists for most people is, I paid it in, I want the benefit. So this is what politicians are up against. There are a lot of ways you can tweak this system and protect the lower end. You can define it any way you want and protect them and start to reduce it slightly the higher up the income scale you go.
Well, let's go to our next student. What's your first name?
David.
David, where are you from?
California.
Ah, okay. Very nice. You see Mary Mello today, man.
Yeah.
Very good.
It's early in the morning.
That California thing.
Kind of the whole
thing. There we go.
Exactly.
What's your question, Dave?
My question is, with the recent polarization, especially in Congress, and having Congress members with loyalties lying outside their constituency base and, you know, their voters, what would probably be the best way for Congress to start functioning again and actually passing legislation instead of just arguing? And furthermore, should the president maybe, instead of trying in the House, instead of trying to appease what Speaker of the House Boehner necessarily wants versus trying to work more with the party whips to actually work out a compromise instead of just a one-sided dogma invasion?
That's a great question. Oh, wow. Congressman, I'll let you take a swipe at that one first.
Well, first of all, I think that what if you really wanted to make Congress work better, you're going to have to revise it significantly. The first thing that's got to go is the filibuster, or at least be substantially reformed. There are likewise things in the House. I happen to be totally against term limits, and I think term limits for leadership positions in the House is wrong too. About the time you get to know your job, you're sitting in the back row again, and I think that's wrong. I think that the whole idea of allowing virtually any amount of money to come from any source and get dumped in there, and the Supreme Court calls it speech, is nonsense. And I think that the money is corrupting, not in the sense that it individually corrupts congressmen, and I'll give you $10,000 if you'll vote this way. I don't think it happens that way. I think it has an overall influence on the body that money is terribly important and you got to be careful how you go about it, in addition to which you spend an enormous amount of your time raising it. So I think without some fundamental changes, fundamental reforms, if you will, of the Congress, it's just going to continue to limp along as it has.
Wow. Bob Hines.
And there's something else that has to be done that cannot be done by the Congress. We have to change the way we redistrict the seats every 10 years when the census says, you know, New York loses a seat and Texas gains a seat and everybody starts drawing lines. And how do they do it? Well, the legislature in the state does it. And if it's controlled by the Democrats, they fix it so that the Democrats get a better deal. Reverse is true in Republicans. This is an equal opportunity offender. Secondly, you have got to fundamentally change it. And the way to change that is to take it out of the hands of the congressman delegation talking to the state legislatures and fixing the deals. You got to remove that. Let me give you an example. After the 2000 census, in 2002, we had new districts all over the country. In California, there were 53 districts. Not one changed party hands. Not one. And it was done by the state legislature, along with the members of Congress who were delegated by their congressional delegation, you know, whichever both parties, and they would go out there and cut deals. Now, in Iowa, the same year, there were six seats. They got another seat. So they had to redistrict. Three seats changed hands. What was the difference? The legislature had nothing to do with it. What had to do with it was they had created a independent group, a commission, if you will, made up of former governors, former Supreme Court judges, things like that, people who were no longer in politics but understood it and were looking for the way to do things right and develop not these funny districts that go like this all over the place, but nice, compact, and contiguous districts of communities of interest.
Yeah.
And that's what the difference is. And more states are beginning to move that way because they see the problem. But until you do something like that, and politics controls, no matter how funny the lines get, it still works for us. Once that goes away, we'll have a different kind of a Congress.
Go ahead, Al, and then I'll jump in. Okay. I got to jump in on this one.
Hunt him back. There are a whole lot of things that have to get done.
First of all, I want to just take a small issue with my good friend Al's number one problem, i.e. the filibuster, which is spoken like a true former member of the House of Representatives.
And that's being rebutted by a good former member of Senate staff.
I was 15 years of the Senate. I have a little different view of the filibuster. I don't particularly like the way it's worked, and it's been changed in a way that really becomes a problem. It didn't just start. It started about 20-some years ago. But anybody who thinks that by fixing the filibuster you're going to fix Washington, I think, is deluding himself or herself. For example, let's suppose there was no filibuster today at all, and the Senate functioned the way the House did. So the Senate would presumably pass some bills, which shows some disrespect for all the Democrats and the differences that they have with among themselves. But let's suppose they pass a bunch of bills. Gee, what happens when it gets to the House? Not much. The filibuster is a problem. I don't think it's the problem. And I was also a little surprised to hear Al talking about money because, gosh, that would seem to suggest that the $1 billion that President Obama spent got him reelected, and we should have changed that. Oh, my God.
Oh,
he does have a point. He does have a point, I will acknowledge, on congressional races and members of Congress who have to end up spending an enormous amount of time raising money to just sort of be competitive. It is a problem a grumpy.
I'm not going to respond to the second part.
Go ahead.
Because that's a bait and switch argument, and I'm not going to bother with it. But when you start talking about the filibuster, now let me see if I got some basics right. Democracy is a place where the majority ultimately rules. Is that right?
Simplified, but okay.
Okay. With appropriate protection for the rights of the minority. Now, the Senate is a place where the minority can rule, where the minority can prevent the majority from ever acting. I maintain the United States Senate is the least democratic institution on the face of the earth. And I don't see how Alan talks his way out of that one.
Bob Hines, you were a parliamentarian type.
It's called the Constitution.
Oh, good Lord. Here we go. Bob Hines, you were a parliamentarian in the House for many years. I want to hear your take on that.
Well, let me just say one other thing first.
All right.
I don't disagree with either one of them, quite frankly. I mean,
how can you do that?
No,
what?
The problem is this.
Does the bench hurt when you sit on it?
The problem is that it has to be adjusted. I don't think you should get rid of it. I think if you're going to filibuster, I think you ought to have to stand up and talk. They don't do that.
So now, you want to go back to the old Capra-esque stand up for 24 hours, Jimmy Stewart
yeah,
talking
out
of the phone book.
See, nobody's going to do that. That's
okay.
But one thing I want to say about what influences the Congress, the problem there. Before, when your parents had not yet met, there were three networks, and they had people like John Chancellor and Walter Cronkite and Harry Reasoner, people who were newsmen, not news readers, and they really knew what they were talking about. And they talked a broader base than we get today. I would suggest that you probably watch more cable news programming, if you watch news programming, than you do network programming. And what do you get? Fox is way over on the right. MSNBC is way over on the left in their commentary. CNN is somewhere in the middle, and there are a few other stations. But the point is this. All you're getting back home, the folks who are sitting in front of their television sets and watching the programs are saying, they're watching the program that tells them what they already believe. And that helps them to go out and vote for people like real liberals or real conservatives, Tea Party people or Looney Tunes less. And that's one of the big problems. We love our local congressman. Everybody else is an idiot.
He calls you Looney Tunes left. Al, I would not take that from you, a former congressman.
He's not a Looney Tunes left. He's retired.
Oh, my gosh. Bob, you started to allude to it, but I got to jump in on this. What I still have not heard, I've heard the blame go to everybody else. It's the filibuster. It's redistricting. It's the media. Nobody takes personal responsibility for the way they're governed. Bottom line, you can't complain if you don't have skin in the game.
Voting intelligently.
I agree with you.
But every time I turn around, and we're part of the media. Nobody listens, but we're part of the media. We are part of the problem. We talk about our positions, and they get our 30-second sound bites. And for all we know, somebody in Minot, North Dakota is going, wow, that Congressman Al, he's a smart dude. I'm going to vote Democrat. Or that Alan Moore, he's really sharp. I'm going to vote Republican. Or that Bob Hines, he's kind of in the middle. I'll be an independent. until the American electorate turns around and says, I got to know what's right for me. I'm going to elect somebody, not because I saw a 30-second soundbite on Fox or MSNBC or CNN. I mean, you're talking to somebody who gets his primary news source is BBC. My second is Canadian Broadcasting. Why? Because that's the news. The news isn't supposed to be flashy and exciting and graphics and intro themes. It's boring. It's supposed to be information so you can make the judgment on how you live your life here in the greatest experiment called America. You have the great opportunity right now as young people to start a trend of writing letters to your congressman, researching the issues. Don't go off of what Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert say. Investigate yourself on how you want to be governed. Hell,
run for office, run for Area Neighborhood Commission or Environmental Commissioner of Sacramento, California, or something. But you have to, until you take responsibility, what are you laughing at for?
I'm not laughing. I'm
saying, break time.
Oh, yeah, here we go.
when we each get our 30 seconds.
Yeah, you're all right.
Filibuster, I see.
That one bugs me. That one actually bugs
you're
me.
You're absolutely correct.
It really does.
Does that satisfy you?
Yeah, it does. It does. All right. Next one. What's your name?
Brian from the great state of New York.
Oh, great state of New York. Just there last night. Fantastic.
Great.
Well, what's your question?
A lot of people have seen this past election as a critical election, particularly for the Republican Party, as their demographic that they lean towards are not in line with the majority of the country. Do you think that this election will sort of wake up the Republican Party to be branching out their policy position to expand their base of electorate?
Let's see. I'm going to toss this one up. Al, I'm going to let you have the final word on this one because you can go to town on this. I pick Bob. Bob, you start this one.
I think it already has affected, let's put it this way, the people who are paying attention to it and are not ideologues. Do I think it has changed the Tea Party people? I think it may have rattled them a little bit. Let's touch base on two things. 2 years ago, in the Senate elections, the Republicans gave two Senate seats away by nominating crazy right-wing nuts. They also elected some right-wing nuts in the House and in the Senate. This year, again, they lost some seats in the House, eight, but they lost two Senate seats that 6-8 months before the election were going to be gifts. So that's four seats. You lost the control of the Senate. Now, what does that tell? That even tells Tea Party people that, you know, somehow or another, we're in a blind alley banging our heads against the wall. We ought to turn around a little bit. And I can't tell you how many people I know, starting with the Speaker, who are very upset about the whole situation. There are a lot of people who think really hard about this. They're in academia. There are people around the country. There are Republicans just who are upset about the fact that it's so goddamn tight. Yeah, we're changing. It's going to be slow. It's going to be tough, but we're going to do it.
Alan Moore.
We better do it or we'll be dead.
Alan Moore, commentary on that one?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very powerful survival instinct in American politics. People make adjustments and in their own races, in their states, their districts, parties. Parties don't control nearly as much as they'd like to. There are party folks who look at what happens in a particular race and think, oh my God, look what happened. We are doomed in this particular Senate race or House race. Having said that, when you look at the presidential race, that really speaks to your point. When you look at who did the Republicans win with? Older, whiter, wealthier people. Not just them, but that's where that was their sweet spot. Where did the Democrats win with they just cleaned up with minorities and with younger single women. Now, those are growing groups. They didn't lose everybody else, needless to say, and the Republicans didn't lose all that they lost to the Democrats, except for African Americans, where it was like 98% or something. But and that was kind of a historic oddity. That's not always going to be the case. But Republicans have a powerful survival instinct, and they're trying to figure out what went wrong in our primaries. Not so much did we get the wrong candidate, because you can't totally control that unless you move that whole process back behind closed doors where it used to be, but we gave the playbook on how to attack Romney to the Democrats in a primary process where they worked him. He wasn't a fabulous politician. President Obama had many vulnerabilities, only a few of which were utilized, and then there was just some kind of random things that happened that tended to fall the president's way. The election ultimately was fairly close in terms of popular vote, and enough, you know, the close enough that if you look at a few of these odd things that have occurred, you could see it having fallen the other way. Having said that, all the trends are bad for Republicans.
Congressman Al looks like he's just ready to just pounce.
No, really, just a couple of things. First of all, I think it's going to take the Republican Party a little while to figure it out, because this always happens left and right. You take a drubbing, and the extremes will say it's because we weren't extreme enough. So you've got to deal with them and pull them back in and have them around long enough to understand that you win them in the middle. You don't win them in the extreme. The second point I'd make is this is not unique to the Republican Party. There's a big cycle, and it's sometimes 30 years, so you barely remember the McGovern period, but that's when the Democrats were in the barrel the way the Republicans are in the barrel now. And we fought our way out of it. You know, it took a while. It took a long while. And how long it's going to take the Republicans, I don't know. But I am old enough to have heard both parties declared dead at least four times. And yet they still seem to be around.
Do we get everything you want to?
Yes.
Oh, great. We appreciate it. We're going to take a break. It'll be the top of the hour coming up. Unfortunately, this is what we would normally call happy hour, where we order our martinis, our wines, our beers, our Jack Daniels, and smoke our cigars. Can we smoke in here?
No, I don't think so. Can we drink in here?
Crap. This is Backroom Politics Special Edition, live from Tenley Campus and American University in Washington, D.C.
Yeah!
We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Let's see, who are we talking about here? Oh, we're talking about Shelley's. Of course, we always talk about Shelley's. Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Shelley's Back Room is a one-of-a-kind here in the nation's capital, a comfortable retreat for cigar aficionados and those who simply want to unwind. Our casual but elegant space features soft lighting, cozy couches, and overstuffed chairs. Shelley's Back Room is a cigar-friendly establishment, but the state-of-the-art air purification system keeps the atmosphere comfortable for smokers and non-smokers alike. Sit back and enjoy yourself while chatting with friends or watching one of our 8 high-definition TVs. Or, heck, come on in on a Tuesday and watch Backroom Politics unfold. Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Premier sponsor of Backroom Politics.
And we're back. This is Backroom Politics in a special edition from the Tenley campus at American University of Washington, D.C. Great discussion today. I've got to tell you something. You know, we've been doing a speech here for now, what, 2-3 years, Jeff? 2-3 years we've been doing this? 4 or 5? Oh, God. It never ceases to amaze me. You know, every time I walk around the Hill, I walk around D.C., I walk around the Capital Region, I get disgruntled. I become jaded. I sit there and go, there's no hope. We just might as well pack it up and go home. We're going to hide in bunkers and eat, you know, Vienna wieners for the rest of our lives. We're done. And then I come to here, and this literally is Congressman Al, the future. I mean, we got future senators, future congresspeople. We might even have a president in here.
Let's hope.
Yeah, I mean, this has got to give you hope. Congressman, what do you think?
Well, I had reason to believe just recently, because the person who was elected to the seat of retiring Norm Dix,
right,
36 years in the Congress, new guy. This is a kid who put up yard signs for me. And it turned out he was also an intern in my office.
You know what that proves?
What?
That proves, one, you're old,
yeah,
and two, I mean, you are having an effect. I hope that we're having an effect on stuff like this.
He is a terrific. He's going to be a great congressman, and he was a good legislator.
Democrat?
He's a Democrat.
And he'll be all right.
Yeah. Well, I know some good Republicans too.
I know.
Much smaller group, of course. But my point is, I absolutely agree with you. And every time I talk to young people, high school included,
yeah,
and college, I think anybody who thinks that this generation is going to hell needs to talk to a few people in this generation.
But I mean, Bob Hines, when we look at the different, because we do this around the Washington area, is there hope in your mind? I mean, you've been around. Out of anybody who should be jaded, you should be jaded as much as anybody. But does this give you a glimmer of hope that we're starting to see the light at the tunnel? We could see days of compromise, civility back in politics?
Look at this group here. It's a large group. I'd say it's at least 100 students. I don't think anybody's left. We've gotten a lot of good questions. I think this shows you that there's an awful lot of talent out there, a lot of people who, if they just, some of them get into the political world, some of them business world, whatever. The fact of the matter is there are going to be an awful lot of these young people who are just going to do wonderful things, and they're all right in front of us.
And I want to ask a question today. Clapping hands, how many of y'all consider yourselves Republicans? Wow. Okay, ready for this, Congressman? How many of y'all consider yourselves Democrats? Oh, my God, a surprise. And a majority liberal people on a college campus.
Give me independence.
Oh, all right. Okay, really. How many of y'all consider yourselves independent?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. There a liberal campus in Washington. I can't believe
it. I'm so surprised.
It's a shock face. But anyways, Alan Moore, when we say that literally this is the future, and you look at as many people as you see in government today coming from places like American University and the other campuses or the other colleges here in D.C., when should they start getting involved? Immediately, right now, afterwards? Is it? I mean, how important is it right now?
I can't resist first. Do you guys know Stefan from Saturday Night Live?
Stop. That is actually something that is pop culture and hip. How do you know that?
Pure accident. When I say this is the future, I want to go. Look, there is no time that is too soon. I've got children. I've got stepchildren and I got grandchildren. I've been in this crazy world of Washington over 40 years. They have different levels of interest, which is not a big surprise, even though they grew up here, they were exposed to some politicians and this like. What I tell them, and I just say to you, is just pay attention to what is going on around you. Inform yourself better. Now, you guys are government students at a great university, so you're not exactly a random group of the country. Just know that most of the people in your age group aren't in college, and most of the people who are in college aren't taking a government class. So,
is he trying to encourage them?
You know, I commend you for taking the class, thinking about these issues, paying attention. Just know that you're this little minority that needs to grow, because I used the phrase earlier, this is a country of low information voters. That's the kind way to put it. And the better informed everybody is and the more involved people are, the greater the benefit for all, including you guys. So stay with it. Pay attention. Challenge your friends. Challenge your parents. But also listen to the other side, because neither side here has all the answers, and there's a lot of really ugly rhetoric out there in social media about, there was plenty of it about the president and plenty of it about Mitt Romney, and it was really kind of horrifying, the venom and anger. These are two good men. One of them won, and he's the president for the next 4 years. Let's make that work. Let's figure out how. But it takes support of people like you to help empower and strengthen politicians who have to make the...
Let's do this. We've got our next student here. What's your first name? Where are you from?
I'm Sam from Pennsylvania.
From Pennsylvania. Oh, the Keystone State.
Ooh.
Nice. Yeah, woo! Yeah, all right. Yeah, enough Homer stuff. All right, what's your question for us?
I have a pretty straightforward question for you guys, who kind of know what's going on in Washington and how things get done, and that is, how do you feel about the possible appointment of current UN Ambassador Susan Rice to Secretary of State?
Ooh, topical question. Yay. Okay. Congressman, I'll let you open up on that one.
You know, I think there's a lot we don't know. For me, did she only repeat what had been given to her by the security folks, in which case the security folks should be on the pan, not her? Or did she go off on her own? And I don't think that's clear. And the decision that you make about her depends very much on what answer you get to that question.
Bob Hines.
And there's also the possibility that in the since it was a matter to happen relatively close to the election, and it could have been embarrassing, there's also the possibility that in the political process, in the White House, someplace else, that people either misled her unintentionally or deliberately. Nobody knows this yet.
Alan Moore.
I would hope it doesn't. It isn't that.
My hunch is that on the one hand, she was sort of poorly served by the system. It looks as though she has not acquitted herself as well as she might have in these meetings with Senators McCain and Graham and Ayotte and then Susan Collins from Maine. This doesn't bode well for her. What that suggests is they felt in those meetings that she was holding something back. Having said that, I think that what's really going on here is distress about the administration's foreign policy. She's a convenient target because she happened to be in this unfortunate, take on this unfortunate role of being given a bunch of talking points, going on five different talk shows and repeating them at a time when people inside the government knew they weren't quite right. And did she know? Did she not know? It's not clear.
But wait a minute. Let me jump in on this one now. I want to ask you a question. That logically, see, I mean, she is the voice of the administration, and she is putting out bad intelligence or misinformation. Either way, that should not be going out to the public until a full investigation happens.
Well, the thing is, if she just had her talking points and said, this is what happened, this is what you use, she's being, if you will, a good staff person, and you don't crucify a person for doing that. What I'm saying, and I sort of question whether she has all the qualifications we want to be Secretary of State anyway, but I believe some of this backlash on her has to do with distress with the administration, and she's a convenient target at this particular point in time. My guess is, though, that she knew a little more than she wants to let on, and by hiding or concealing that, she's created a big problem.
They call that cover-up everywhere else.
They don't. People do this all the time. This isn't a cover-up. People are always trying to use nuance and care and not create an additional problem. What was unusual in this case is that we know it was wrong, and we know that people in the administration knew it was wrong, and we know in the original talking points it was present, and it got removed. We don't know who did what.
Congressman, let me ask you this question. When we talk about this, we talk about a situation where people are defending Susan Rice for giving information out to the public and out to the UN based on the intelligence that she had been given by our intelligence community and that we thought was right. Yet Democrats crucify President George W. Bush for doing the same thing when they talk about weapons of mass destruction, where he had then Secretary of State Colin Powell going up in front on intelligence that we believed was actionable at the time, wrong as it was. Is there a certain hypocrisy in the Democrats screaming, oh, this is unfair?
Well, in politics, is there hypocrisy?
Okay, Charlie.
I think the two things are significantly different. One, they were, I think, the thing you mentioned was vastly more important. Colin Powell was given bad information, too, that he delivered to the UN, for which he was subsequently very angry and let it be known publicly. So there is a similarity there. What I am saying is, if you're going to point a finger of fault at somebody, you need to find out who came up with the misinformation. Once you know that, you've got your culprit.
Agree with that. Alan?
And was Susan Rice in the loop?
Yeah.
Was she aware that there was a different point of view that existed, but she went with the party line, so to speak, for possibly very good reasons? We don't always like to tell our enemies everything we know.
They keep your mouth shut.
But you have to say something. You've got to be really careful. But it sounds like either she got these bad talking points, or she was trying to use those talking points and not come completely clean, and now hasn't come completely clean with these senior senators. We don't know that. I think she's become a tainted potential candidate, maybe justifiably and maybe not, and sometimes it doesn't matter.
Look, I'm a Republican. I will tell you right now, I think that Susan Rice has been vilified, and unrightly so. I think that this goes higher. I think that there are issues inside the intelligence community that should be addressed in this. There are issues inside Foggy Bottom at State Department that need to be addressed, and they have not addressed them. I think what they've done to Susan Rice is unfair. I don't think it's her fault. However, you don't put out or try and spin information on something as internationally huge as the death of a seated U.S. ambassador to a foreign country. You sit there, you can give out little bits of, look, it's a tragedy. You know, we mourn for the family of our fallen heroes. We will find whoever does this, and we will bring them to justice. Don't tell us it's because of a Muslim video. That's just insanity. I don't get it. I don't get it. Alan, you disagree.
Well, I think we've covered the subject.
Yeah, okay. Now, your first name?
I'm Nathan.
Where are you from?
From Chicago, Illinois.
Oh, excellent. Go ahead.
My question is, with Palestine getting more recognition on the international stage, getting non-member observer status in the UN, do you ever foresee a time where the United States turns more pro-Palestine as opposed to its historical support of the Israelis?
Congressman Al.
I'm glad I'm not running for office. I have long felt that we needed to rebalance that situation. I think proceeding along the paths that are currently in place will lead us to where we came from, i.e., in a circle and nowhere. I think that Yasser Arafat was an extraordinarily difficult person to deal with. Someone once said he never passed up an opportunity to pass up an opportunity. But things have changed since then. And I think that we can be more even-handed and still be sure that we are there in case somebody decides they want to wipe Israel off the face of the earth. I think we just simply would put a stop to that.
Bob Hines.
Well, I think I fundamentally agree with Al. We will certainly do everything we can to stop Israel from being knocked off the face of the earth. But I agree with Al that we have to find a way to have a better relationship with the Palestinian state or whatever it is right now. And we have got to do that, and we have to try to find some way to help the two sides bridge a gap which is so huge today that it's almost impossible to see how they can do it because there are so many hotheads on both sides.
Right. Alan Moore?
Well, we've got the Palestinians having their own problem of bridging the gap inside the world of Palestinians. They're hugely divided. And the newly identified group in the UN does not represent the Hamas folks in Gaza. They got plenty of issues of their own. The question was whether we think that move might might feed into this larger question. The U.S. is sort of, I'm not an expert on this field, which will be obvious. I tend to be somebody who looks for compromise, looks to be even-handed, and yet as you watch events over in that part of the world year after year after year, it's going to take smarter people than me to figure out how to do it. But I don't think that some fundamental shift in U.S. policy is the answer. President Carter, President Clinton, Presidents Bush, and then President Obama, who talked about reconfiguring our relationship, and that created political problems on the ground. This is tough, tough stuff. The Palestinians don't speak with one voice. The Israelis don't necessarily speak with one voice, and we're continuing to send different signals. And they're the ones who are shooting at each other, lobbing missiles back and forth, targeting military leaders with smart bombs. I am not optimistic. I don't know that it's the U.S. policy that dominates here. If we think the Congress is bad, think about the challenges in that part of the world and two sides getting together to some common ground.
And what's your name?
My name's Patricio. I'm from Madrid, Spain.
Madrid, Spain. Oh, wow. International student. Fantastic. What's your question, Patricio?
Well, people like to throw around what the biggest threat to the U.S. is every once in a while, whether it be global warming, China, to terrorists. And I just was curious what you all thought was the greatest threat to the U.S.
Spain. We could just control Spain.
Yeah. Get your spending under control. You're killing the rest of us. Actually, that brings up a very valid point. I'll tell you something. My opinion, the fiscal stability of the global economy is the biggest national threat. Our deficit spending creates a huge threat to us. Until the global economy gets into sync with the global reality, that is going to be our big. I mean, even everybody looks at China as being this booming economy. They're coming into their first recession as a global economic power, and they're going to have issues. We're seeing what's happening in Greece. You know, the future of the EU and the euro lays in a fine, fine balance. I mean, for the first time that I can remember, Canadians are getting better exchange rates on our American dollar. I got Canadians coming over going, hey, we're going shopping. I can get that Prada purse for $5 Canadian. They love this. We as Americans and we globally, I mean, you're having issues with austerity. You know, they want to give, they want to take. Big problems. That's going to be our biggest issue. Congressman Allen?
Well, I agree with that. But I think in order to get there, we'll go back to something else I said earlier, I think we need to do some major changes in how we do business as a government, both in the legislative branch and in the administrative branch, in order to be able to, in fact, grab a hold of these issues, such as the one you described, and do something effective.
Bob Hines.
Everything that's been said is true. How you pick the worst one is difficult to see. But take, for example, we haven't talked a whole lot about the Middle East, but look what's going on. We had an Arab Spring, and there isn't a single country except Tunisia that was touched by the Arab Spring that is even beginning to be stable. Not one. I mean, you know, we've got the president of Egypt saying he can rule by decree, the Supreme Court refusing, saying he can't. They have a constitution that says Sharia law is the new constitution, which they're going to vote on, is
based on Sharia law.
Now that's pretty ridiculous. You've got Sunni and Shiite fights all over the place. I mean, it's worse than Republicans and Democrats. That's hard to believe. They actually shoot each other. So the fact of the matter is, you know, that's a constant problem. It's not the kind of a problem that's going to attack us. As a matter of fact, I don't really see anybody who's going to attack us militarily, or we or them. But the fact of the matter is, those things could possibly happen. But I don't think the Russians are going to do it. The Chinese aren't going to do it.
Bob, let me ask you a question. You don't think that the Russians, do the Russians pose more of a threat now than they did, may say, 10 years ago?
Possibly because Putin is a little bit, he's in trouble. And he's, you know, one way to get people behind you is to start trouble. But you don't see that happening necessarily. I mean, what you have is a whole bunch of problems domestically and internationally. The world economy is maybe the biggest universal problem. If the economy was better all over the place, it would be much better for everybody because there'd be fewer internal disputes. Everybody would be feeling a little bit better. I don't know that it's ever going to happen.
Alan Moore.
I certainly agree that without some economic stability and strength here and around the world, almost nothing else can move forward. Now, one thing that feeds that is aging populations, is demographics. It feeds the problem here. It feeds the problem in most of the industrialized countries. I don't know what you do about that, but in terms of risk, the economy and the underlying weaknesses and the reasons for it tend to push aside real legitimate current concerns about global climate change. Not that we know what to do about it, but that may pose the biggest risk of all. But in terms of human behavior, though, I think that economic instability, the Middle East, and proliferation of small weapons has put terrorism high on the list of what we're exposed to. And if you can imagine terrorists getting their hands on nuclear material, whether it's a weapon or simply a bunch of material that can be used to contaminate New York City, Washington, D.C., London, pick a city. There's exposure out there. We are spending hundreds, and the rest of the world, hundreds of billions of dollars for border security, for intelligence. It's just an enormous amount of money that gets spent to try to protect us against those risks. They are very real, and we don't even get to know everything that's happening, because if we did, then we would be sharing information.
Al, we got to go to break. When we come back, we're going to finish up our last segment and possibly get a quick word with the head of the Washington semester in Washington program here, Dr. Jeffrey Crouch here at American University. But we'll be back after the break. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio, special edition from the Temley campus at American University in Washington, D.C.
Yeah!
We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Back Room is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the size of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Back Room, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Back Room, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties. Thank you.
And we're back here live in a special edition of Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics from the Tenley campus at American University in Washington, D.C. In our last segment here at American University, has been fantastic format, fantastic questions here today. Can't always amazed at the quality of questions we get from this crew. But let's go into our final segment. Your name?
My name is Scott Hammersley. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. And my question is pertaining to the Department of Health and Human Services versus Florida, better known as the Affordable Care Act. What I was curious to think is that it deals specifically with the tax was the main debate over the issue. And do you think the fact that Chief Justice Roberts declared it a penalty and a tax instead of a penalty, therefore forcing these people into commerce, do you think that's constitutional? And why do you think in a court that would be typically considered conservative 5-4 that he sided with debatably more liberal?
If the Supreme Court says it's constitutional,
it is.
Yeah. Bottom line, Alan, Bob?
I think that one of the considerations that the Chief Justice had was that in recent years they have come under a great deal of criticism from scholars and Congress, members of Congress. And I think he was trying to find a way to legitimately say, and I think he did, legitimately say this is a tax, because it is a tax. You can call it a fee, but it's fundamentally a tax. I think he did that partly to get this problem behind the country, and also to show the political leadership of the country that the Supreme Court was aware that we have to solve our problems, and this was a way to do it, and it was reasonable to do it. I wouldn't have maybe picked it exactly myself, but it was a reasonable way to solve it, and it helped the court get past some of the problems that they've had with the political people in the country.
Congressman Al.
Well, I just said it. If they said it was constitutional, it's constitutional.
Alan Moore?
Yeah, I'm not so sure this was a tax. Bob said it's a tax. I don't know that. There was one justice who said it was a tax. The other eight didn't join that part of the opinion, that set of reasoning. What I think, though, and it really relates to what Bob was saying, I think that the court really does have a lot of respect for the legislature, and the legislature passed this. It was heated, it was challenging, it was difficult, but it got the votes. And to undo that would be very not just problematic in terms of how the country works, but problematic in terms of this notion of deference to the legislature. And he found a way that he was comfortable with to support the legislative judgment, and as Al said, and so it is constitutional.
Great. We have another question coming up to the chair right now. Oh my gosh, it's a female question. What's your name, ma'am?
I'm Jenny.
Where are you from?
I'm from Delaware.
Oh, big commute. Okay. And somebody doing out blue hens, what? Really? Oh, another Delaware person. What's your question, Jenny?
So I have a sister with a disability, and recently her medical needs have not been met financially. Do you think that cutting funding for Medicaid is a logical way to reduce the budget deficit?
Wow. Wow. Congressman Al, I'm going to let you have first one on that one.
I think you have to make a decision on a much broader basis than that as to whether there are certain kinds of things that can use less financing than others. I don't know whether her situation would fall into one of those categories. But I would much rather mess around with Social Security, frankly, than I would with Medicare.
Medicaid. I want to jump in on this real quick. This is something personal to me. My nephew, I have a nephew with Down syndrome. My brother-in-law and my sister are both naval officers, but they still rely on special programs to help support them raising my nephew. Great programs, some of that federally funded. Instead of taking away and supporting programs that support those with
with disabilities that need that support. We need to do a better job of getting rid of the just rampant, just incomprehensible fraud going on in Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security programs. That is the biggest. We just saw on I just saw on the news the other day that CNN was reporting that a large dialysis company in the U.S. had thrown out hundreds of millions of dollars worth of medication, of medicine, just threw it out and still billed Medicare for it. Insanity. Absolute insanity. Until we fix the problem, and some of it's bureaucratic, we're not going to have – it's going to continue. That's our first problem. Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, Medicaid is growing very, very rapidly. About three-fourths of Medicaid's money pays for long-term care for aged people in nursing homes and disabled folks. But there's you have to meet low-income criteria to be eligible for Medicaid. Some states want just to get the money from the feds and say, let us do it. So there's kind of a movement of some governors to cut Medicaid. I think the challenge in all of these programs is to figure out, it's put everything on the table and be open to the possibility of making changes, but to be sure if you do make changes that you protect the most vulnerable and acknowledge that although the needs may be significant, for people who are not as poor, we can't afford to do everything for everyone. And that's the challenge.
Okay. Bob?
Seems to me that there are so many places in some of the programs that can be adjusted for one reason or another. But certainly that portion of the population that is disabled and are not wealthy, let's put it that way, and that's most of the disabled, certainly. I think that's one of the last places you should ever look for any reduction in services.
Right. Thanks a lot. Appreciate your question. I mean, with the fraud and with the increasing reliance on these programs, we got to take a serious look at how the non-discretionary. I mean, this is non-discretionary spending we're talking about, and that's a huge chunk of our budget. Ma'am, what is your name?
Esther.
Esther, where are you from, Esther?
Nigeria.
You're from Nigeria. Oh, fantastic. Are you having fun here in D.C.?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Until just now.
Is there anybody you'd like to say? Now you can tell your family, hey, you can listen to us on the radio. Anybody you want to say hi to in Nigeria? No.
Okay,
do you have a question?
Yes. Since my coming here, I've heard a lot about the deficit, the budget deficit.
Uh-huh.
So, and from the elections that I've watched, I've heard, people talking about how they were going to, my question is that why is everybody talking about helping the middle class and taking money from the upper class? And also, how do you think that the government can fix it?
That's a great question. I'll go let Bob, you take a shot at that. It's a great question. How do we fix the deficit when we're trying to point fingers at the upper class and the middle class, trying to take, and then everybody kind of disregards the lower income side of the house. Bob?
Well, what has to be done, quite frankly, is that you have to review all these programs, and we have to raise some dollars, and we have to adjust some programs. Now, it's sort of like this. Each party is saying, you know, you can't touch my little finger, but I'll be happy to cut off your arm. Now, it seems to me the way to do that is that everybody is involved, and every program has to be looked at, and every program can be adjusted to some degree or another. Every tax program can be adjusted. There's no reason why people who are making millions of dollars can't pay a little bit more, because they'll never notice it, maybe.
Right.
It's also true that everybody should have some skin in the game. Now, by that I mean this. Even if you're only making $25,000 a year, I would love to see a law that said, even there, you pay, $100 to federal tax, just so you're part of the system. I don't want to tax the poor, but I want them to feel not that just they're getting things, but they're contributing things. And obviously, if you have more, you can contribute more, and it won't hurt you. And it seems to me that's where we have to go. And the problem, the big problem we talked about earlier, is that both sides are saying, don't even cut off my little finger, but I'll cut off your arm.
Congressman Al?
Well, I'm reminded of the bank robber who was once asked why he robbed banks, and he said, because that's where the money is. And I think one of the reasons that people are trying to get the rich to pay a little bit more is that that's where the money is. I think it's as simple as that.
Alan Moore.
We had a balanced budget in this country at the end of President Clinton's term, and at that time, about just under 20% of our entire economy was being spent by the government, 19.6%, and federal tax revenues were the same amount. And those are fairly close to historical norms. Today, the government is spending about 24% of this recession-hit, somewhat smaller economy. Taxes are in the 15 to 16% range. So we've got this huge distance between what we're spending and what we're raising, and trying to close that without harming, but hoping to get growth out of the economy is our challenge. We are a very generous country. We spend about $1 trillion a year on needs tested, that is programs where you look at somebody's income programs, but that still means there are a lot of people left out.
Okay, thank you very much. I hope you enjoy D.C. And we got our final question. Our final question of the show. You, what is your name?
Hi, I'm Carla.
Carla, where are you from?
Florida.
Where in Florida?
Miami.
Where in Miami? I come from Miami.
Oh.
Do you know? I know. Anyway, Carla, what's your question?
So I'm a communications major, and I was just wondering what you thought of the media's involvement in the last election. Do you think that it's taking a turn for the worst or taking a turn for the better in terms of what we're looking forward to in the future?
We got a short time frame here, kids, so keep it short real quick, guys. Congressman Al, Emmy Award-winning broadcaster that you are.
I think the media handled this election about as well as they've handled recent elections. I think there's a fundamental problem ever since we got so much news from cable. But it didn't change drastically for this last election.
Bob Hines.
I would agree with Al. It's unfortunate that we have so much of the news from cable because it's so biased both ways. And it helps. It just reinforces people's views. It doesn't help us.
Alan Moore?
I don't think the problem is with the media. I think the problem is with us.
Yep.
That we have more sources than you can possibly imagine. We've still got nightly news. We've got all of these cable networks. We've got still a few surviving, limping along newspapers. But who watches? Who reads? Who listens? There's ample opportunity out there. I had plenty of problems with different things in the news, but I think the problem is more with the target of the news than with the news, the people who speak the news.
Thank you very much. We are coming short on time here for our segments, but we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to close out the show with Tell Me a Story and a quick word from Jeff Crouch. But this is Backroom Politics live from the Temley campus at American University in Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches, they've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
one more time. One more once.
Back here at American University's Tenley campus in Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
This has been a special edition of Backroom Politics here at the great American University. Joining us right now, Dr. Jeffrey Crouch, the head of the Washington, the semester in Washington program here at American. Jeff, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Real quickly, in a couple of seconds, tell us about the program that you guys have here.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this is the Washington Mentorship Program. I teach American politics in the program, and my colleague Jason Fabrikant also teaches American politics, and my other colleague Pepe Lustig teaches cross-cultural communications. And our program is about 170 students. They come to Washington, D.C. As first-year students, first semester, first year.
How's the program been going on?
Been around since about fall of 2004, I believe. I started, I think, the year after it started.
Oh, wow. Wow. How many students do you have enrolled here?
Right. Well, in this program.
In the program here today?
In the program here today, this is 4 classes out of 6.
Oh, wow.
So there should be roughly 100 or so.
Excellent. Excellent. Yeah. Well, Jeff, we always love having you on the show. Obviously, we love coming here to American University. Hope you enjoyed having us. Thanks for hosting us today.
Of course, thank you.
This is, we're going to forego, Al, I know you're going to be happy. We're going to forego Tell Me a Story. So on behalf of Congressman Al Swift, Bob Hines, Alan Moore, I am your moderator, Radio's Justin Russell. We will be back live next Tuesday from Shelley's Back Room in Washington, D.C. Bob?
The place to be.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week live from Shelley's. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye. We'll be right back.
Thank you.